First of all, let me start by saying thank you to all those who are here. And we are always excited about Representative Briner, who is our vice chair, and that election happened at our last meeting. And just before we get into the agenda, there are some members who are excused today, or at least called and said that they would not be able to make it, but we really do make sure that they get all the information as well. Senator Reiner, Senator Rosen, and Senator Miller will not be with us today, and so I just wanted to make sure that I made that announcement earlier. The other thing I want to call the members' attention to is that we have the statute that we operate under also included in your packet so that you can refer to that. Senator Sharon and Representative Brandon and I talked about that sometime before, about wanting to make sure that this commission was really clear as to what our duties and powers are, and so we just wanted to make sure that that was clear. So the first order of business on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from October 3rd, 2013 meeting, and I'd love to get a motion for approval of those minutes if there are no corrections.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All those, it's been moved by Vice Chair Briner. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And nays say nay. The minutes have been approved. And just so I set the context of today's meeting as well, as you know, at our October 3rd meeting, what we wanted to do is make sure we had regularly scheduled meetings, and we did that. But there was one meeting that we wanted to have in between the October 3rd meeting and our next meeting, which would be November 7th, which was this meeting. And the reason why we wanted to have this meeting, because we wanted to make sure that the authority could come and articulate as clearly as possible what the agreements are that have been entered into. And so that is what we wanted to do. Is there anything else that anyone needs to say before we have the chair from the authority come forward?
Mr.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I sent an email. I wasn't necessarily expecting it to be on this agenda, but a status update regarding the various publicly financed venues competing against one another for concerts. If we can just and your LA was terrific in terms of her response and what's been worked on, but it'd be nice for this group to get an update either at the next meeting or perhaps one after that.
Representative Atkins, thank you so much. And I must concur that I think I do have the best, you know, legislative assistant around, Joan A. McAfee, who's been quite helpful, and all the others that have worked so diligently on these matters. And so we will look at that for the next meeting. And, in fact, Senator Reiner had asked me about that some time ago as well. And he's one of the individuals who, unfortunately, will not be able to make our meetings coming down. So we will have a discussion at the end of the meeting around, you know, other members being able to participate by way of conference call or telephone as well. So, yes, we will definitely take care of that, Representative Atkins. Senator Sharon.
Thank you.
Thank you. I was really interested in, and I'm glad that we've included the subdivisions related to our commission's responsibilities and authorities, and I would like to suggest that we design, if it would be agreeable with our leadership, a regular agenda that has in it a section called Old Business or something like that, and then list these the charges of our commission on each agenda. And so it helps me. It's a process that helps me be clear that if there's an agenda item, what it's relating to in the overall legislation that gives us our charges. They are providing financial oversight of the authority, adoption of a statewide authority structure for the operation and management of sports facilities and entertainment venues,
right,
which under the jurisdiction of the authority, and creating a comprehensive management plan that alleviates booking and scheduling concerns. So we've sort of been driven, I think, by reactive stuff that's going on maybe in the media. And I'd like us to turn that around and get back to us establishing the agenda related to what our charges actually are. And to that end, we all have received, I think, a report on the financial statement audit for the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority, and certainly comprehending that and understanding if there's anything in relationship to that that we should be paying attention to could then be added to our agenda. So that's my suggestion. I I know that we're going to be taking a look at the use agreement. That's been what everybody's been talking about. But we have charges in here that go beyond that, and I think we should become more structured about creating an agenda that relates very specifically to the responsibilities of the committee.
Well said, Senator Sharon. That's one of the things that Representative Briner and I talked about, as well as Senator Rosen. That's why we are looking at making sure the next meeting is much more structured around the collaborations or the sports facilities being able to potentially come together and to be under the same authority. And so that's a part of that discussion going forward, and we will be more on offense than defense.
Yeah.
Anything else, Representative Briner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, I agree with what you're saying, and what I would say about the way we ended up with this oddly aligned meeting, the 3 weeks out instead of our monthly approach to a regularly scheduled meeting, was to play catch-up so that we were in a position to be more proactive, because we hadn't met in such a long time originally, and so the negotiations around, you know, the use agreement and development agreements were proceeding, and we really hadn't participated in our role in terms of oversight. So I think this is, we're trying to get into that position where we can be more proactive with our statutory assigned duties. So,
and with that being said, I think this is an appropriate transition to have Chair Michelle Kelm-Helgen come to the podium, and then she will take us through the update on the stadium development agreement and stadium use agreement, and we'll let you go from there. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. If it's okay with the committee, I would ask that Craig Skime could join me. He has been kind of a consultant staff to the authority in negotiating these agreements. So in case there's questions or details,
we would
Craig,
love
you
to
want
to
just
that.
Join me?
Welcome to the committee. Well, commission is so hard because those words are sometimes interchangeable. So you know my intent. And it's good, before you get ready to go, to see Lester Bagley also here as well. So go ahead, Chair Kelm-Helgen.
Okay. I thought the best way to do this, we have given you ahead of time three pieces of information. There's the summary of the development agreement. There's the summary of the use agreement. And then there's kind of a combined piece that's called highlights of the development and use agreements. I think the best thing that really will focus the conversation on things that probably are of interest, at least where I've gotten the most questions, would be the highlights, and we'll just kind of step through that. And I'm fine if you want to ask questions along the way or discuss things along the way, or if you would prefer I go through it all and then we talk, either way is fine.
Chair, it's up to you. Either way that you would like for us to
okay,
better
well, why don't
go
I start? And if there are questions or comments and, you know, we can deal with them along the way, I think that would be fine.
Sounds good.
All right. So first of all, just the overall financing. I think everyone obviously is familiar with the overall agreement, with the total cost being $975, of which the state is putting in $348 million, and the city of Minneapolis, through the convention center tax that actually comes to the state, $150 million is dedicated to this project. And then the Vikings, $477 million, as defined in the development agreement, essentially the NFL is putting in $200 million, of which a portion is a loan and a portion comes in as a grant. And then $177 million comes in through equity and or borrowing, but that's money that comes in through the team. And then the team will use the seat builder's license, the SBLs, the personal seat licenses, if you will, that will contribute $100 million toward the $477 million. Just to talk a little bit more about the SBLs, because that I know has caused a great deal of interest and some discussion. Essentially, the overall program will be sold at $125 million because $25 million will be used to pay the sales costs for the program as well as to finance the seat licenses for people over time so that they can provide one of the things that we thought was going to be really important in this seat licensing program was for people to have the ability to pay for these licenses over time. So the way the program is structured, the first 3 years can be done in three payments with no interest. So 2014, 2015, 2016, payments can be made in three installments with no interest. Beyond that, the people are able to finance at a very good interest rate. There'll be a five-year financing plan over and above the first 3 years with no interest. So essentially, people have the option to finance these over the course of 8 years. The program, essentially, the $100 million that we're getting out of these seat licenses to be put into the building, compared to the programs, recent programs that have been done in other stadiums, and it's listed there, they're all over $400 million, is a relatively, well, it speaks for itself. It essentially is about a quarter of what some of these other stadiums have used. What it does do is we have provided a cap. We talked about the team itself will develop the specific, you know, what every section and every seat will sell for. And essentially what the authority did is work on kind of an overall framework that would provide some limitations. So essentially what it said was the most expensive seat license cannot be higher than $10,000 in the stadium. Now, that's not to say that there will be more than a few thousand that would be up in that over 9,000 price range, but essentially what it says is none can be higher than 10. The average seat license is going to be $2,500. So as you can well imagine, this will require that a relatively few number would be up in the high range and a much larger number in order to get that average of 2,500 would be down in the lower ranges. And the lowest price seat license actually will be right around, there'll be some lower price seat licenses at $500, as I understand it. And then there are some financing options, as I mentioned. The one thing we do mention is the fact that these seat licenses actually in other stadiums end up being viewed by some as an investment because they can be sold by the whoever pays for that seat license can turn around in a year to 10, 15 and sell that seat license to someone else. So that's the seat license program. As we talk about this, I always try to explain. So that's kind of, I mentioned where the investment on the part of the team is coming from. The new agreement, essentially, based on the legislation, kind of takes a different approach to the revenue that is secured by the stadium authority and the revenue that the team actually has. And essentially what it's done is it's given, and this, again, is detailed in the use agreement, but it's reflective of the legislation. Because essentially what the legislature decided was that the authority would have a more secure, guaranteed source of revenue, if you will. And whereas now under the current, and I've had a few questions by members about how our revenue comes now and what's different about this new agreement. Currently, the authority gets a big portion of its revenue from things like the concession revenue on game day comes to the authority, and then a portion of that is shared with the team. Under this agreement, essentially now, we will have a guaranteed source of revenue. The legislation actually outlined this specifically. The team will pay a use fee or rent, if you will, of $8.5 million per year. And that $8.5 million will increase by 3% each year, obviously for inflation. In addition, the team will pay $1.5 million annually for capital enhancements, and that also will increase by $3 million a year. So essentially, there will be $10 million between the rent and the capital investment that the team will pay for those 10 game days a year. So essentially, it's really, if you look at it, it's $1 million a game. In addition, the team will pay all their game day expenses, which typically have been calculated to be about $3 million a year. So really, there'll be $13 million coming in to the authority each year to cover the costs and the rent, the use fee, if you will, of the team. So that for us, and under the legislation, it really anticipated that we would get that as sort of our guaranteed, more stable source of revenue. That $13 million will come to close to, you know, again, our costs are just in some ways somewhat unknown in the new stadium, but our calculations indicate that that will be probably right around 70% of our annual operating cost. That will be a significant, obviously, that's a significant portion from those 10 days of money that will cover the expenses and the operating costs for the stadium. I do always point out, because I do a lot of presentations around the state, talk to different groups, and I do point out that it's that operating income that's coming from the team for those 10 game days that really will allow us to continue to subsidize all the other events that are played in the stadium a year. You know, we play over 500 high school, college baseball games, for example. Well, those teams come in, we schedule them all spring long so they don't have to go to Texas and Florida in the case of colleges. And it's not just the University of Minnesota. It's private schools, it's two-year institutions, it's Minscu campuses. They all rely on our indoor stadium to make sure that they can schedule those spring games. That saves them a lot of money from traveling to warm weather states to play those games. The money they pay us, which is like around $500 an hour or $500 per game, I mean, it barely pays to turn the lights on for that amount of money in that stadium. Clearly, those things are heavily subsidized, and we obviously will continue to do that. So those things like rollerblading in the dome, which we do all winter long and will continue to do in the new dome. People come, they pay a dollar to skate in the dome, and it's just a great benefit. We do marching band competitions that are heavily subsidized, obviously. We host a lot of, obviously, the state high school football championships, the state high school girls and boys soccer championships. All summer long, there are little league groups that come in with football clinics and soccer clinics, baseball clinics. These things will all continue. Your legislation mandates that all these events be provided in the new stadium. And that, to me, is really what makes it the people's stadium. And those events will continue to be subsidized. Now, obviously, we get the revenue from all authority event days. I want to emphasize things like the Super Bowl, the Final Four, concerts. Well, right now we've got a bid in for the BCS for these college bowl game series. All that revenue comes to the authority, comes to the public building. The concession revenues from all those authority events come to us. All that concession revenue comes to us. And the rental of all the club and event spaces. This building is going to be an entirely different building from the dome. There's going to be a lot of opportunity for some of these other public spaces to be used year-round by many different groups, some of whom will pay some rent to use that space, whether it's, you know, weddings, whatever. And those, that revenue will come to the authority. We'll be getting the tour revenue. I want to remind people, in some of these stadiums, Dallas, and again, I don't claim to be Dallas. I know that's a whole different level of football madness that goes on there. But, you know, I think our stadium is going to be every bit as interesting and attractive for people to want to come and see. It's going to be very different with this ETFE roof and many features that are very unusual. All that tour revenue will come to the authority. In Dallas, they have 400,000 visitors a year come and tour that stadium. They pay $20 a tour, which would be $8 million in rent. If we get even a quarter of that or 20% of that, that's a significant amount of revenue. That will come to the authority. There's communication revenue that will be in this facility. There's a lot of agreements that are yet to be worked out with companies that will come in and provide Wi-Fi and broadband and that kind of thing. And for some of those things, there's revenues that are gained from some of those people who come in and wire up the building. And we will be able to have, we're going to split those revenues with the team. And again, all these things are outlined in detail in the agreements. While the team definitely has the advertising revenue for their game days, a lot of these ribbon boards that are in the stadium, there's one or two, depending upon our budget, of these ribbon boards that will have advertising that go around. If you've been in Target Field, you've seen them. So some of those boards are, some of that advertising revenue for our event days will be able to sell as well. So we will definitely have, and then again, the concession revenues. We will have those revenue streams coming from those things. Now the Vikings, while they are paying us this significant amount of money, $10 million a year, plus their game day expenses, they will have revenue sources as well. And their revenue sources will include, and these things, again, were outlined in the legislation, but we've done a, you know, identified all this in more detail and how it would work in the use agreement. There'll be naming rights revenue. There'll be sponsorships that they're able to get. There'll be concession revenues for Viking events. I should mention, however, because there's been some discussion, you know, currently under the current system, the concession revenue comes to the authority, and then a percentage through us is given to the team. So there was some concern that, you know, how are we going to know how much concession revenue the team is getting from this? And that's true because, to a certain extent, that revenue will go directly to the team. However, what I realized as we talked through this with our staff and our people, it will be the authority that holds the contract for concessions. So even though the revenue from game day concessions will go to the team, we will be able to track and report. That will be public information as to how much money that is coming in for the team on concession revenues. Just because the way the contract will be set up, we will be holding that contract. And then, of course, any of the concession revenues from authority events will come to us. So you will have information on that. The ticket sales from the Vikings event, from the Viking games, will go to the Vikings. And then, as I mentioned, the communications revenue will be split between the authority and the team. The way this whole process has worked, and again, as identified in the legislation, there's been a stadium design and construction group that was put together. It had two members from the team and two members from the authority. And it was this group that essentially was responsible for all the design, building, construction issues that we've gotten to so far. And all that work has always taken both sides to agree. Now that we are coming up to, we're expecting probably midweek, next week, Mortensen, who is our construction firm, to come to a guaranteed maximum price. And they'll give us a guaranteed maximum price. They will take this on as a construction manager at risk. So essentially, once they give us the guaranteed maximum price, then they assume the risk for building this project within that number. And I guarantee you the number we will be at, we will definitely, we realize we have a budget we're working in, and it's going to be that $975 budget. So they'll come in with a guaranteed maximum price. After that, the authority essentially becomes the developer, and we will then hold, well, we currently hold all these contracts anyway. But at that point then, the stadium design group, really the only input they have at that point is for any major changes that essentially change anything related to what are called the minimum design standards. And those minimum design standards that really define everything in the building to a certain level are all detailed in that use agreement as well. The construction management, as I mentioned, the authority essentially assumes the role of developer at that point. Mortenson will become the construction manager at risk, and we've got the contingency fund. There still is. Mortenson has a $25 million contingency fund right now that they're carrying in the construction budget. The authority is carrying what's called an owner's contingency, which is $37.5 million. It's that money that will be used as changes come in and things come up that, you know, obviously, as it's defined, for contingencies and things that are unanticipated to keep us on budget. However, as I think we mentioned, Mortenson, in putting out some of their early bid packages to try to identify, you know, get to that guaranteed maximum price number, they've been putting out some packages, getting bids in for a major portion of our project. And things are definitely coming in higher than what we had anticipated. I think with the construction market picking up all over the state, we're definitely seeing that impact. So all the way along, we've had to, you know, make some decisions about, you know, we've got a lot of different options that we're looking at for the building. And things, to a certain extent, have either been cut out or they've been put on now what's called an ad alternate list. And there's an alternate list that's detailed in that use agreement or the development agreement. And so these ad alternates are there. And as this contingency money is released, as we are able to say, okay, fine, we're still staying on budget at this point once we start construction, that contingency money then can be used to put in some of those additional things. The team, however, the Vikings decided as we were going through and making some of these decisions as to what's in and what's out, that there were certain things that they wanted to make sure that we could keep in, even though our budget may not look like it was going to be able to absorb it early on. So they identified $13 million of things that were important, and they essentially said, okay, we're going to put up a letter of credit for $13 million, and so we will assure that that money will be there so that we can add those things back into the budget and make sure that they're designed into the building right now. However, as contingency dollars then become available, if there is contingency money available, then they can be paid back, if you will, out of those contingency dollars if they are available for those extra items that they wanted to put in. For the project, it was a great addition. It was really good that we essentially right now have this extra $13 million to add to our budget, and yet we don't have to release those contingency dollars today because we may need them. And if we need them because things keep there's things that come up that we have to spend extra money on, there may not be contingency dollars to pay back the team. In that case, then, the Vikings essentially would be writing a check for an additional $13 million. So that's definitely appreciated in this process. I just will mention, because we had a lot of questions about it, and we also covered it in our agreement, the due diligence that was done. The required financial due diligence that the legislation called for in terms of verifying that the money that the team definitely had the money available to make good on their $477 million commitment to this project, the normal due diligence, $158,000, was paid by the project as part of our normal cost. However, the Vikings did agree to reimburse the authority for the additional due diligence that was done related to the New Jersey lawsuit, and that was $219,000, and that portion is being paid by the team. So the project schedule, as we mentioned, and this is outlined as well, we're staying pretty much on schedule for October for the GMP to come in from Mortenson. As I mentioned, we should be getting that next week. And then November on or about that first week in November, the team financing will close. And then mid-November, the state bond sale will take place. After the team financing closes, the state bond sale will go forward, and as will the groundbreaking. So right now we are on budget and on schedule, and that's where we plan to stay. The agreement terms, it's a 30-year contract. The team, you know, commitment is there to stay in the new stadium for 30 years, and then there is an opportunity for four consecutive five-year renewals or 20 years after that. International games, we identified the team, as I think everyone knows, played their first one of those in London, and what we have done is said we've agreed that they can play three international games in the first 15 years of the lease, including the ones that are done before the building is built, and then three after in the second 15 years. And the idea is there, I think everyone sees, you know, yes, I think the international games bring some value, but they're also just in terms of economic benefits or loss if the game isn't played here. There is some impact on the stadium and the region as a whole for those games going not being played here. So that's for the reason why we have some limitations for that. And then again, as part of the legislation, it called for affordable tickets. We've agreed, the team has agreed, that 3,250 affordable tickets, which essentially are being defined as costing no more than 80% of what the average price is for a single game in a section, will be available. And then I just remind people that the legislation allowed that the team would have essentially an option for 5 years that they could bring in an MLS team under similar terms that they have with their football team. So essentially, if you think about that, they would pay the franchise fee to bring them in, and it's pretty hefty. I mean, those franchise fees are estimated to be around $50 million. So they'd pay the franchise fee. They could bring them in. They would be a tenant in the facility, similar to the Vikings. There would be kind of based on average, you know, trying to allow for some similarities to what an NFL revenue stream would be. We would identify a rent. Typically, an MLS franchise plays around 17 home games. So they would pay rent for that. And they would have the rights to be the home MLS team here in the new stadium. And they would get the concession revenues and the advertising revenues and things similar to what they get for the football team. And we would get additional rent and probably a portion capital investment fee, kind of similar arrangements on a scale as what we've done for the football team. So that's kind of the highlights. Are there questions, comments, things you want more information on?
Vice Chair Brainerd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Kelmhalkan, I'm wondering if you could give us a range of figures around the so-called affordable tickets, the 80%. What might that actually look like for the purchaser?
Lester, would you want to, since these are the kind of things that the Vikings are perhaps better suited to answer. Would it be okay if we had Lester Bagley from the Vikings answer that question?
Welcome, Mr. Bagley. I did mention earlier that you were here, so welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Happy to be here. Lester Bagley, Vice President of Public Affairs for the Minnesota Vikings. Regarding the affordable ticket agreement as part of the negotiation, as Michelle, Chair Kelmhalkan, spoke to, we do not have a specific definition of ticket prices and plans, but as Chair Kelmhalkan said, it is 80% of the lowest priced segment of tickets. So if that section were $50, and that's probably a good ballpark figure, those tickets would be $40, and they would be available on a game-to-game basis, and there would be 3,250 of them available.
At minimum.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. That helps to assign a dollar amount, so the average person has an idea whether they can actually attend a Vikings game sometime in their future. So I appreciate that. That makes a difference. Around $40 does seem affordable.
Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Questions for both Mr. Bagley and Chair Kim Hilgen. On the personal seat licenses, how does that tie into the luxury boxes? Is that a totally separate entity, or will the licenses be charged on those boxes as well?
To either testifier.
Yeah, no, there will not be seat licenses in those suites. That's sold separately.
Representative Anderson?
Are the seat licenses subject to the state sales tax?
No.
Okay.
Representative Anderson, follow-up?
Just more questions.
Yes, go ahead.
On the guaranteed max price, once that's established by Mortenson, if they see cost overruns coming, can they themselves omit pieces of the stadium, or how would that occur if Mortenson sees cost overruns?
To either testify.
Well, once the whole idea of setting a guaranteed maximum price, and the reason that Mortenson is doing these kind of early bids, they aren't locked in, but they are getting actual numbers from subcontractors. Because once they set the guaranteed maximum price, they essentially are committing that any cost overruns, unless we make changes to the design, they will bear those cost overruns. So that is something that they are committing to. And any change to the design, just so you know, the way the legislation was written, any changes have to be agreed, material changes to these what we call minimum design standards, which really define what the building will look like, have to be agreed to between the team and the authority. So even though we're the developer, the idea is we spend all this time agreeing to what the stadium should look like. We get Mortenson, you know, our architect designs it. Mortenson agrees to build it. And then we as the authority say, oh, gosh, we don't really think maybe we'll cut the number of suites in half because we want to save some money or put some money somewhere else. Well, we couldn't do that without the agreement of the team. So with the team putting in half the money, this ensures on both parties' behalf that while we are the developer and we can make decisions that, you know, gosh, maybe this material versus that would be less expensive and would be a better way to go, that probably wouldn't be a minimum design standard, or this door should go here rather than there or whatever. Though all those kind of decisions we can make on our own. But anything that changes the basic design can't be done without the two parties agreeing. But to your point, it will be once Mortenson gives us that guaranteed maximum price, they are basically guaranteeing that they will build it for that price. So that's why this is a really important exercise that we've been going through. And, of course, having to make some really hard decisions, because we want to make sure that the building falls within that number that the state has designated as their contribution, and, of course, from the team's perspective as well.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. A question on the annual maintenance fees. As I recall in the legislation that talked about the city of Minneapolis also paying some of those annual fees, you didn't mention that. Is that still part of the agreement?
Yes.
Chair Kim Hilgen.
Yes. The city also pays essentially part of their $150 million contribution contributes to the operating cost of the stadium.
She's in addition, so they have
150. Greg.
If I may.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Craig Skime, consultant to the authority. The city's component really breaks into two pieces. One is the payment of about $150 million toward capital, which is done through these tax collections. The second is an ongoing payment for operations of a base number of $6 million a year plus an additional $1.5 million a year for capital. Now, there is a period of time where the state is actually kind of upfronting that money and then is repaid once the convention center taxes become more available. But at the end of the day, really, it's $6 million a year in operating, $1.5 million a year in operating from that source, in addition to the rent that the chair spoke of.
Okay.
Representative Anderson, any follow-up?
Yeah, just one for Mr. Bagley. We talked about the international games and the authority and you agreeing on 3 and 15 years. Is that any different than other teams, or is that a pretty standard number for other NFL teams as well?
Mr. Bagley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm not sure how other teams' leases spell out this issue, but it is, or use agreements, it is an issue within the NFL. A team to play in London, to be a home team, you obviously have to give up a home game, and many are subject to use agreements with language that require the team to play all of their home games in the stadium. Some of the teams, obviously there's a home team, there's a visiting team. The Steelers were the visiting team. They were not subject to their use agreement. I'm not sure exactly how it lays out with the rest of the 32 NFL teams. In terms of the international game, we did feel it was an important opportunity and to enhance the Vikings brand globally as well as the NFL's brand. It's a very important initiative for the NFL. And given where we are in the transition from the current facility into a new stadium, we felt that it was an opportunity at this juncture to try to take advantage and step out and do that international game. In terms of going forward, it is spelled out in the use agreement, as you note, and as Chair Kelm-Helgen spelled out in her comments. But, right now, we're looking forward to playing in a new stadium. We talked about it for a long time. We worked hard on it. A lot of people in this building and in this state worked very hard on it. We want to play our games in the new stadium, and that's going to be a major factor going forward. We do have the ability per the use agreement, but our focus is going to be building a home field advantage and playing in this great stadium that everybody is going to take advantage of in the state of Minnesota.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I have a series of questions as well, if that's okay.
That's okay.
On the issue of the tickets that Representative Breinert was asking about, the approximate price, are these tickets going to be sold? How will they be sold, and how can the public be assured that there will not be a markup on these tickets because they're purchased in bulk by scalpers, and then turn around and ends up people are really not able to access an affordable ticket to the game?
Chair Kelm-Helgen or Mr. Bagley.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, it's a very important question and an important safeguard that we want to make sure that these tickets are accessible and available. They will not be sold as season tickets, so they'll be available on a game to game basis. And as far as the specifics as how those are to be sold, I'll need to get back to you on that. And unless Jeff, you have an answer on that, but I'm going to have to get more information as to how we will ensure those safeguards to make sure that they are available. They can't be bought up by a third-party ticket vendor, but we want to make sure that per the spirit of the legislation and discussions that we had with you, the people in this room, and over many years, that these tickets are available, accessible to Minnesotans on a game-to-game basis.
I know at the time that we were working on some of the agreements, there was discussion that maybe they would even go through some nonprofits or something like that, where maybe there's a group that, or a number of groups that game by game are given access to those tickets and able to, have them available for some of their people, or they're bought through someone else. For exactly the reason you're mentioning, it wouldn't be something where somebody could just come and buy them up and then resell them for twice the face value. But that will be an important thing to look at, and we'll make sure that we let you know what the plan is when we have it.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. And this question is for whomever is able to best answer it. I have a series here. On the SLBs, the if I understood what was said, the $100 million that is established from that resource is actually going to be $125 million because, if I understood correctly, the goal is to allow the purchasers of those to be able to finance that over a period of time. So is the $25 million the costs that are anticipated to carry that, the interest earnings on that, and are those then paid for by the purchaser through the pricing of this seat, or is that something that the team is willing to absorb?
Chair Kim Helgen.
Well, the program, the total amount that will be sold would be, and that's assuming that every seat license is sold, and you never know with that. I mean, there definitely are programs that don't sell 100% of what's available, and whatever isn't sold is the team has to make up that difference. But essentially, the way it's been designed, it would be done with the actual amount going into the construction project that would be put into the project is $100 million. That's the net amount that goes into the project. However, it's being designed as a $125 million program because $25 million of it would go to repay to pay for the sales costs and also the interest costs. So the number, as you look at it, the amount is, as people have looked at, okay, how much of the $477 million coming from the Vikings is coming from the seat licenses? The answer to that is $100 million. However, the program itself is being sold at $125 million in total, with 25 of it paying for the interest and essentially the sales and carrying costs of that program. But only 100 of it is going into the stadium.
Senator Sharon.
And I assume then the rest of that is that the pricing of these will include that 25. Each seat license will have an integrated amount of money to pay for the $25 million that we're talking about for the costs that are not going directly in for the construction of the facility.
Right.
All right. The next question I have is on the contingency dollars that you were talking about. I was not clear about this. Mortensen has a contingency of $25 million. The owner, that's Sports Authority, $37.5 million. And these contingencies, if I heard you describe it correctly, are not for the basic design for which you have a guaranteed development agreement with that the risk is with Mortensen, but it's for other add-ons or changes that that we might have on a list that we'd like to add into this, if that's correct. Then my second question in relationship to that is the $13 million that you're talking about from the Vikes comes with their determining what those contingencies would be ahead of time. Did I understand that correctly?
Chair Kim Helgen.
Yeah. If you think about it, so the 975 overall construction budget, if you will, the portion related to the portion that Mortensen is doing for its construction piece includes as part of their budget an extra kind of extra $25 million that's listed as their contingency. So as they go through their project, as they have bids come in higher, that kind of thing, they can take that contingency, but they've got to get our approval. I mean, it's all got to be done. It all must be done, you know, with us knowing what they're doing and approving what they're doing. But it's that $25 million, and this is real standard in construction projects. And in the end,
may I follow up? And if those contingencies do not exist, then the remaining $25 million, should there be not additional contingencies, remains with the company.
Yeah, well, it's dealt with in a very specific way, Craig.
Yeah, there are specific releases of contingency that take place over time, and at the end of the project, if there is contingency left, there is a splitting of that, and I'd have to look at the exact mechanics, but basically there's a splitting of the savings that would come from that.
Senator Sharon?
Gwan, I'm sorry, I interrupted.
So,
you were going to finish.
No, no. So as that money comes available then, and again, this is standard in construction projects, then you have additional things as releases take place, because what you assume is this is for contingencies, but along the way your level of risk decreases the further you go, so you feel more comfortable saying, okay, fine, we'll release these contingencies. So what we've done is we've come up with, and this is in the agreement, it's the attachment.
It's an attachment, I can tell you.
For the ad alternates.
Exhibit I.
Exhibit I in the use agreement. And essentially what we've done is we've said, okay, there's things that...
In the development agreement.
So the authority identified a list of things that we were interested in adding. And, of course, the things we're adding are... Thank you. Are things like shelling out auxiliary locker rooms, two extra escalators, laundry, extra laundry equipment. They're very... So if there is additional contingency money, these are things we would add back in. The team, in terms of things that they're interested in, also has a list of things in that exhibit that they're interested in. So essentially what the team said was, we would like to upfront the money to make sure that some of these things that we're interested in get integrated into the building up front. Because, of course, some of these things, as time goes on, it's too late to add them. There's some things that are really bolt on, bolt off. You can add them anytime. Laundry equipment would probably be one of them. But building additional locker rooms, for example, there's a point in time where the design construction process goes, it's too late. So those are the kind of things that it wasn't that, but, you know, some of those things, the team said, we want to make sure it's there. Well, the way the agreement is written, and again, with this sort of partnership and everybody having to agree, essentially what we've said is, as far as the contingency dollars are used, it'll be as contingency money becomes available. It will sort of be dollar for dollar, because the authority has their list of things they want to add. The team has their list. So let's just say that $5,000, and then there's release dates of this contingency. So let's say the first release says there's $5,000 available. So the authority would be able to identify $2,500 in additional things that we would do, and the team would identify, and we're talking millions of dollars. So we'd identify, you know, $2.5 million. They'd identify $2.5 million. The way the agreement is written, we would still be able to do our $2.5 million. But then the team would have the choice. They could either add more things in, or they could essentially repay themselves out of that $13 million in contingency that they already paid up front. But in the end, if there's not $26 million, if you want to just look at it that way, let's just say they decided they wanted to be repaid out of all that. If there's not $26 million in contingency dollars, they probably wouldn't be repaid their full $13 million amount, because it's sort of dollar for dollar. The authority chooses, the team chooses. So that's how it will be done. But in the end, there's a very real chance that the team will have to write a check for at least a portion of that contingency money. So they are making, but I just wanted to be clear that I didn't want to give the false impression that they were just putting in an additional $13 million, because it really is kind of an advance to contingency potentially, but they may or may not get paid back.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know how it goes. You start with one question and then more comes up. Two questions. One on the city's contributions. Mm-hmm. I understand, and it's been too long since I've looked at the legislation, and that's my bad, but I understand the team's $8.5 million a year in operating and $1.5 million in capital. It's rent. Your tenants, the public is the owner, you're the tenants. I don't understand the city's contribution, and maybe Chair Kelnhelgen, can you walk me through what the rationale is when the city is not a tenant? Why are they contributing also to operations and capital?
Chair Kelnhelgen.
At the time of the legislation, it was really, and again, I'd probably defer to the bill authors to a certain extent, but it was decided that it would be important to make sure that, I mean, the city's contribution was basically a certain amount, a fixed amount. And of that, it was decided that it would be important to have a portion of that be attributed to basically operating costs. Part of it came in the reason that it was going to be a long time because the money from the city didn't start flowing until later because they first are paying off the convention center bonds. It was determined that those later, as the operating costs of the stadium got higher, that some of that money would be wise from a just security risk standpoint to have coming into the building from an operating standpoint later on. So it really was more just a case of how those revenues would be kind of apportioned, if you will.
Representative Davney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Keeping on related themes, I don't actually expect the stadium to come in under budget. I don't actually expect there to be savings. But if there are, there's an agreement as to how those will be divided. Who are the parties that would receive savings if they occurred?
Chair Kelnhelgen.
Well, the savings, so to speak, would only go to add things into the building from the team's perspective and the authority's perspective. No money would come back to either one of us. It would just be building improvements. And we're talking about things like escalators and, you know, different kinds of seating systems. And, I mean, we aren't really talking about, they're things that are just basic building improvements by and large. But they would go into the building. The only savings that would go to anyone is there is definitely written into the contract of Mortenson that in the end, if there are savings,
they get a portion of those savings, which was actually part of the legislation.
And that also was part of the legislation. But we're talking about, like,
It's a percentage of the last portion of contingency, and I don't have that number right in front of me. But
maybe several million dollars. It's not, like, anything in a large, like, tens of millions or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's... And that is only at the very end if you end up with this final savings, that a portion of that comes back to them. And Craig's right, the legislation actually talked about that and how that would be done.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Davney.
Question for you. Chair Kelnhelgen used the magic word of bonds. Is this an appropriate time to check in with either the authority or anyone else on where we're at in bond sales, what interest rates are being anticipated, things like that?
Sure. If the chair has that information, unless the chair wants to talk about that at our next meeting.
The only thing I can tell you is the state is proceeding with the preparation of the bond sale, but beyond that, I can't really give you any information about what they're looking at with interest rates.
Thank you, Mr.
I'd
Chair.
Have to defer to them.
Thank you, Chair Kelnhelgen.
Any other questions? Representative Atkins, did you say you had some questions?
Sure. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first, thank you for the greater frequency of meetings. I really do appreciate it. And I think to the panelists who've joined us, this has been very helpful. I should, for Mr. Bagley's sake, I've got a surgically repaired Achilles now. I'm moving better. Still can't see over an offensive line, but if you need me on Sundays,
can you return punts?
I'll step up for you.
I can see you back there.
I was thinking apparently anybody can play quarterback now. So I got, but I wish you the best with sorting that out. I'll tell you on the seat licensing, rather than ask questions about that, I'll just simply say this. I don't like seat licenses. You know, the taxpayers of Minnesota were already on the hook for half. This essentially puts Minnesotans on the hook for half plus $100 million. So rather than ask a bunch of questions, it kind of I just simply don't like that approach, but I understand that the legislation provided for it. The real question I had was about the Well, let me ask a background question relative to the disclosure of the revenues that the authority has coming in and the disclosure of the revenues that the team has coming in. When the Metrodome has been in use for, when did that, was it 1982 that it went into service? Mm-hmm. How many times has that lease been renegotiated? Either of you guys know?
Any of the testifiers?
I don't know.
Well,
and actually I put Mr. McCormick, our head of house research, on the spot a little earlier as well. Nobody seems to know, but everybody says multiple times. But it'd be interesting to go back and actually add up how many times.
We can find that out and let you know.
I'd appreciate. I actually went online, you know, tried to do the Google thing and figure it out, and there were multiple articles about how many times it had been renegotiated. Which is what prompted my concern and what I shared with the chair and members of this committee earlier in the week, is the authority's revenues are all fully disclosed, but the team revenues are not. And the reason that to me is so disconcerting is that I think it puts the public at a distinct competitive disadvantage in the event of a renegotiation of the lease. And Mr. Bagley, bless you, if you can tell me today that it'll never be renegotiated for the next 30 or, well, conceivably 50 years, right? Madam Chair, I think that potentially it goes out 50 years. If the lease will never be renegotiated, then I guess I don't have as significant of a concern. But I do have a very significant concern if there is a likelihood, and I think there is, that at some point the lease will be renegotiated and the rents and various things will be renegotiated. Because then if they know what we've got coming in for revenues, but we don't know what the team has coming in for revenues, I think it puts us at a distinct disadvantage from a negotiation standpoint. So that's my concern, and I just put it on the table. I'll let you folks do your best. Can you address that concern for me? And I guess to the Vikings, I mean, would you just be open to disclosing all the revenues and telling us what they are, and then that would alleviate the concern right away.
Any of the testifiers want to chime in?
You want to start? I can follow up.
From our perspective, I do think that, I do know that when leases have been renegotiated, depending upon who initiates it, let's just say the team came to us and said, you know, for whatever reasons, we're in hard times and we can't afford to keep paying this rent. Clearly, we could go in and say, well, in order for us to consider that, you would have to demonstrate to us by opening up your books what it would be. So that, to me, would be, you know, on one hand, we do now have especially this guaranteed source of revenue from the team, and it increases in 3% every year. So I'm fairly confident that we should be, from the authority's perspective, you know, we should be somewhat protected because we do have these payments, and the capital investment payment also increases 3% a year. So I feel like we're fairly covered on that. Now, if they did come to us and, as you suggest, want to renegotiate that, and I do believe that was part of the reason some of the Metrodome leases were changed when the Twins left and, you know, the Dome started getting older and revenues were affected and, you know, there were some, you know, indications that it was not a very fair revenue split, so to speak. I know that they did require some look into the books, so to speak, but I wasn't there at the time, so I can.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I would just make a couple quick points as follow-up to Chair Kelm-Helgen and just to your question about disclosure of revenues. One, the legislation addressed that issue, and we, you know, we'll adhere to the legislation. But also, too, you know, the Vikings are a private business, as are the Twins, the Wild, the Timberwolves, the Lynx. While we root for them and support them, their revenues streams are private. And to Chair Kelm-Helgen's point, the last point I'd make is that we exchanged a $477 million guarantee commitment up front and $10 million on an annual basis, escalating by 3%. And this $10 million annually, 8.5 rent, 1.5 capital improvements, is the highest rent payment in the NFL. So the Vikings in this new stadium will be paying the most rent in the NFL. that agreement, the 50-50 roughly on the capital and the $10 million annually escalating, is a significant private investment, and we exchange those commitments for this agreement and those revenue streams, if you would. That's how I'd respond to your question. Thank you.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Bagley. And I genuinely appreciate that. And I also, in researching it, that was my understanding too, Mr. Bagley, and I appreciate you sharing that, that it is the highest rent payment, I think, of any facility in the country, bar none. So and what I'm actually getting at, and what Ms. Kelmhelgen made a good point about, is if the team comes back and wants to renegotiate, you could ask them to open up their books. And I would expect that you would. What I suspect is I think the team is going to make a lot of money and is going to do really well down the road, and that we may want to go back and renegotiate and say, you know, rather than a 3% bump on an annual basis, maybe it ought to be greater than that. Because 5 or 10 years down the road after you win that Super Bowl that's coming here to the Twin Cities in 2017 or 2018, that the revenues will go up dramatically. And we won't have a picture of that from our side of the negotiations. We won't know that other than to suspect it. And, you know, we talked earlier, Mr. Chairman, about, and I think Senator Sharon said it, about trying to be proactive. And if there was ever a time to be proactive about trying to get, even if it's a disclosure by the team simply to the authority and not to the Star Tribune or Channel 4 or Channel 5 or 9 or 11, so that they would have a sense of where we stand from a negotiation standpoint. Because I think what's going to happen, we'll all be long gone, but 10 years from now, the legislature will sit here and there will be this expectation or this assumption that the team is making a huge amount of money in 2022 or 2025 or whenever it happens to be. But nobody's going to know that. We're going to be getting rent at $10 million plus 3%, and that's going to be substantially less than that's kind of where my inquiry goes. And it seemed that now would be the time to have that discussion rather than try to do it 10 years from now when clearly the team would not be inclined to want to share that information at that time. I set the stage for that. I hope we can continue to have some of those discussions, if not a complete public disclosure, at least a sharing between two parties of what those revenues are. And you're right, Mr. Bagley, you're absolutely right. It's the team is a private entity. I understand you've got those revenue streams are ones that the team is counting on as a private entity, but you're playing in a public facility and one that's being subsidized to the tune of almost $500 million. So if there was a sharing, at least so that both sides of the partnership were on the same basis in terms of sharing information, I think that would be appreciated. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, then Senator Sharon.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have kind of a what-if question. It sounds like there may be some kind of an aftermarket on these personal seat licenses. And just say, for example, if a guy has a seat with a $5,000 seat license and he moves out of state and gives up his Vikings tickets and he tries to sell his seat license and all he can get is $2,500 for it, or say he wants $8,000 for it. Is he going to have to sell that? How are you going to handle a ticket without a seat license and keep those two together?
He would have
Chair Kelmhelgen, or
well, I mean, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, the seat license would stay with those season tickets. So he could decide if it was not, let's just say that it was a $5,000 seat license, and it is true, depending upon how the team does, those prices probably year to year go up or down. What he would be able to do if he didn't want to sell that seat license right away and he was moving, he could sell his season tickets for a few years to someone else and still have the seat license and just allow somebody to use those tickets until he was ready to actually transfer to sell the seat license on the open market along with those tickets. Is that
yes.
a fair representation? So you don't have to, but he would have to sell the season tickets essentially separately if he didn't want to sell the license at that point.
Senator Sheehan.
It's sort of a way in which the public can have an investment in the team, make money on it or not, based on the value of that seat. But my question really is a follow-up to Representative Atkins. I'm wondering if the authority can say, as you look to the future during the 30 years, we've asked this before in terms of negotiating certain outcomes, where are the points at which you have some leverage, I guess, to renegotiate in the course, the lease time is not up, but are there points that you anticipate where the pressure will build to create an interest on either our part or on the part of the Vikings to engage in renegotiations? And can you anticipate what those might be?
Chair Kim Helgen.
Well, the one thing I have done in the last year is I have toured and met with many other stadium authorities. In particular, we have really focused on those stadiums where they're publicly owned buildings along with private teams. And as I've talked to people and really tried to, discern what things are important, a couple things jump out. First of all, I think you're right. There are various points. I mean, the one thing will happen similar to maybe what happened in the Metrodome. Along the way, I think the one thing we've done a much better job of is making sure that we have this capital investment fund to keep the building current. But it's going to be our decision as to how that money is spent and how those resources, and really from a capital investment standpoint, how we're really going to maintain this building and what kinds of things will be done. And over time, we hope to build up a healthy reserve so that as industry standards change and technology changes and that kind of thing, we can make improvements. My guess is that at various points in time, the team is going to have things that they want, and there'll be some things that will be negotiated. And I would see some of those points as being opportunities potentially to look at agreements that we have as there's things they want and they want us to be investing the stadium money on and the public money on. So to me, that's part of it. I have heard from a lot of, as we've talked to other people, a couple things. First of all, the one thing that everyone always says is, to be perfectly honest, the team success really becomes our success, because having a successful team so that they can invest in players and, their ball team and their program helps them. But it also, overall, our stadium does become known for the Minnesota Vikings. And the more successful the Vikings are, in a very real sense, other stadium authorities have told me it helps us. It helps us attract events. It helps us just overall having people, obviously, for the city and the state and the economic development and the money that comes to the hotels and restaurants. And I mean, there is definitely, I'm sure you can track as the team becomes more popular and makes more money on concessions. I know we see it. I mean, there's a huge, the more excitement there is about the Vikings at various points. I mean, look at the city sales tax revenues. I mean, there's definitely spikes in the state sales tax revenue as well. So the more successful, and I have heard this over and over and over from authorities, and these are public groups that have relationships with private teams, and they're like, try hard to make sure you view this like a partnership, because in a lot of ways, in the end, the more their success brings revenue to the area, to the city, and ultimately helps your stadium. Now, there's a balance. I know that my role is to look at the public investment and the revenues that come in and to protect the public interest. And I absolutely guarantee you I see that and I hold that as my mission. So it's a balance, but to your question, I think there will be various points where they'll want things, and maybe that's a point that things can be looked at.
Senator Sharon?
I'm reminded, I almost hate asking this question because it's a memory problem. But I did hear Representative Anderson ask the question about whether or not there would be sales tax on the sale of these tickets. And I'm trying to recall what the understanding is about sales tax on tickets for any event or entertainment event like this, or is this treated uniquely?
Chair Kim Hogan.
Okay, I'm going to again. There's not a ticket tax. Yeah,
there is a sales tax on tickets, if that's the question. There is not a ticket tax. I think the question that was asked was not about tickets. It was about suites or something.
License, the seating license.
Seat license,
yeah.
Yes.
There is not a sales, but there is a sales tax on the tickets, on the Viking tickets as well as all of our tickets, event tickets. We definitely pay that, but not on the seat licenses.
I see.
Follow-up, Senator?
Thank you. I think that what percentage of the seats will be... Okay, I'm just trying to understand why we would not have that be taxed.
Well, the whole idea of, and again, you can
change this,
like it or not, but I mean, I know people have a hard time with these seat licenses. But the whole idea of the seat licenses is, in all of these buildings, that you're essentially selling this up front so that you have the money to put into the building. So the idea, and that's really, frankly, why the authority is involved in the sale of it, so that, frankly, that it isn't taxed. Because if you tax it, then there obviously is less money. So you'd have to, if you want to try to get $100 million, you'd have to sell that much more in order to get the money to go into the building. So the idea is that it's sold up front. It doesn't go into the pocket of the team. It goes into the building. However, I realize that people look at it like, well, that's just a portion of money that, you know, comes through the public that they don't have to borrow or, you know, take out of their own equity. But the idea is the money comes up front and then it's able to go into the building.
Well, I guess I understand that, and yeah. I meant my statement earlier. It really is a way for an individual to make an investment in the team, by a seat for $5,000, not pay sales tax on it. But what if I buy that and I sell it in? You don't have to answer this question, but I sell it in so many years for $15,000. Am I taxed on the? As I would in another investment on its increased value. You may not be able to add.
I don't know the answer to that. That would be Myron Franz.
Vice Chair Briner.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to put Representative Atkins' concerns in a context, and I'm thinking that there's a challenge here for both our staffs, the commission staff, the legislative staffs, and your staffs to consider what we might know in a broad sense historically about both revenue streams, revenue sharing models, and both public and private data designations in other stadium agreements throughout the country. And I think it might behoove us to have that knowledge base if we're going to pursue this discussion. You know, I think is there a narrow set of models here, or, you know, of definition of terms, or are there some options that others have used that we might want to be aware of that addresses Representative Atkins' concerns about protecting the public interest in future potential renegotiations? So I just want to put that out there for us to all think about how we might do our homework in as broad and objective a way as possible in approaching this.
Any other questions before we go forward? Seeing none, I do want to thank you all for your information today. And to the commission, I think Vice Chair Barnett has another question.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to give Mr. Bagley a chance to possibly update us. I know that Representative Atkins referred earlier to a potential Super Bowl that might occur in this new facility, and I know there's been some existing discussions, and I thought this might be a good note to end on.
Mr. Bagley.
Madam Chair, thank you. Yes, we were on October 8th, Minnesota, was shortlisted as a finalist to host Super Bowl 2018 in Minneapolis at the new stadium, and it's something that we've been working on for a long time prior to passing, working with you all to pass the legislation, something that we've been talking with the NFL leadership about, other teams, and this is an opportunity for our state to generate some excitement and some economic impact as a reward, if you will, in return on this investment that we're putting into the stadium. There's a process that they go through. We were shortlisted. Our competition is Indianapolis and New Orleans for the three finalists. The Vikings, as the lead with the NFL, and it is an NFL decision voted on by owners, and it'll be voted on next May of 2014. It is a requirement now that you apply for a three-year cycle. So Minnesota has a bid in for 2018, 2019, and 2020, and the one that's coming up is 2018. They're all set up through then. It'll be Super Bowl 52. We have a very good chance of achieving that. It's a significant economic impact. The New Orleans Convention and Visitors Bureau estimated $300 to $400 million in direct spending in their state, in their city. So a great opportunity, but something that we'll need legislative, political, and community support for. And there's a process as we establish a host committee that will be put together and a bid committee that will need to deliver a bid by April 1 of 2014. And then we'll push hard to try to get that event here. There's no doubt that we have a great state, a great community, Minneapolis and St. Paul, great hospitality. And now we're going to have a great venue. And it's just one of, Chair Kelmhagen referred to the BCS. They're here on Sunday. They're going to be at the Green Bay, Minnesota game. And looking at the site, getting a presentation from the chair on the new stadium. They're very interested in bringing the BCS championship game to Minneapolis, to Minnesota in 2017. We also are underway in conversations with the NCAA to get back in the rotation on Final Fours and regionals. So Super Bowl is a great opportunity. We're excited about it, and it would not have been here for us as an opportunity without the support of the public, and we're appreciative and excited about that great chance that we have to host the Super Bowl.
I just want to add that we have had just unbelievable interest already in our new building. And when we sit down and meet with everyone from the NCAA, the BCS folks, as Lester mentioned, are coming on Sunday. And there is a great deal of interest, and I think we are going to be successful in, even before this facility is built, in having some of these events booked. And the economic impact of this is hugely significant to the entire state. Indianapolis has done an economic report. The impact of the 2012 Super Bowl game they identify at $337 million. I mean, it really is the total contribution of the state. The $350 million probably in today's dollars, you know, updated for by 2 years, probably would, by 2018, more than make up for what the state has put into this facility. And the NCAA, the Final Four events, and even some of the wrestling, gymnastics, the economic impact from these is major. And so I see that as being a big part of my job moving forward, is to be going out and selling and marketing this building and making the state benefit from the investment that's been made, as well as all the individual communities. So,
thank you so much. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This isn't a question as much as just a request. If you have that data from the past Super Bowls, the BCS championship. I think I was talking to a representative from Minneapolis about there's apparently a bid going in for an NCAA Final Four. I know that's kind of far afield. I think most of us are probably interested in seeing what those figures are. If you have them at
Absolutely.
Your fingertips and can forward them to us.
There's a report that Indianapolis put together from Lucas Oil Field on the impact in the last 4 years of these events, and it's very detailed, and we can send you that report. I'll make sure we send it to the whole committee.
Great. Thank you.
Very much appreciated. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Commission, we have our next meeting scheduled for November 7th. One of the things that's been put on the table, and I wanted to make sure that we cleared with the body, is the prospect or the opportunity for individuals who cannot make it physically here, like, let's say, for an example, Senator Reinert, because he's teaching and it's a little more difficult for him to make it from Duluth. They want to have access to the meetings by way of telephone. Now, it's my understanding, after talking to Vice Chair Reinert and also some of the folks from the legislative committee staff, is that this has been done in the past with other commissions. The only difference is that whoever's on the telephone has an inability to vote. So if there was a matter that we were voting about, but at this particular time, I don't see us voting on anything in particular, but just so that you know about that. So I'm putting that out there just to see if there's any opposition to members of our commission being able to participate in the meetings by way of telephone.
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, a good courtesy to Senator Reinert in particular. I know he was.
Yes. Okay, so it looks like we're all favorable.
Okay.
Well, thank you so very much. So we'll make sure that that option's available, but make sure that November 7th is on your calendar. Okay, thank you so much, and have a great day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate you all.
Thank you.
Gavel, sir.
Gavel, you up.
Boom.
Meeting adjourned.
Okay.